And we are back on Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. His name was La Rochefoucauld, Robert de La Rochefoucauld. And he is the real-life James Bond you may not have learned about in your history class. During World War II, La Rochefoucauld was a teenager when Germany invaded France, sparking a fierce patriotism in him that would drive him to become a member of the resistance. In his new book, The Saboteur, The Aristocrat Who Became France's Most Daring Anti-Nazi Commando, author Paul Kix has brought to light the life of a Frenchman with a personal vendetta against the Nazis who invaded his home country. And we're pleased that it brings Paul Kix to the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
In your day job, you're the editor of ESPN Magazine.
Yeah, editor.
Sorry deputy, for the promotion.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so that's sports.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with Nazis, France, World War II. How did you get to this?
It started with an obituary in the New York Times. I've always had interest outside of sports. I've written for The New Yorker, for GQ, and when I write for those places, I don't write about sports. I'd always wanted to write a book, and when I read Robert's obituary, I thought, oh, now this is the book that I should be writing. And ultimately it was.
Okay, so talk about La Rochefoucauld's life before he joined the resistance.
It's amazing. He comes from one of the oldest families in France, the fourth oldest family. The history of the La Rochefoucaulds stretches across 1,000 years of French history.
Wow.
They are like the Kennedys if the Kennedys could have shaped the United States for 1,000 years. He grew up in chateaus. He had a very privileged life, and at the outbreak of World War II, in part because of the way that his family had shaped previous generations of French history, he thought that he should write his own chapter.
Mm-hmm. And when his father was imprisoned by the Nazis, right?
He was, yeah.
And another interesting thing is he met Hitler.
He did, yes.
Tell that story.
So, in part because of his privileged youth, he was able to go to exclusive boarding schools throughout France. And one of them was in Austria. And this would have been in mid-1930s. And one day they take a hike and they go to Hitler's Alpine retreat. And they see these line of Mercedes wend their way down this drive. And they're with a priest who sort of is standing the boys back. And then the line of Mercedes stop. And out of one of them is Adolf Hitler himself, and he goes down the line, and he greets all the boys, and Robert tries out some German, doesn't speak it very well, and Hitler says in response, Franzosen, so Frenchman, and that was the encounter, and Robert actually admitted in his memoir that he came away from that sort of in awe of Hitler, in large part because of the power that the man held. He didn't yet understand to what end that power would be wielded, but he was impressed by the power.
So how old was he?
He would have been around 14 or 15 at
that
time.
So even at 14 or 15, he could see that this person who had not achieved the stature that he would achieve later, that he was somebody to remember. Did Hitler look then the way we all see him now?
I would imagine so. Yeah,
the it same was only mustache.
It was the same mustache. It was only a few years before the outbreak of war.
All right. So what caused La Rochefoucauld to become part of the resistance?
A few things. Number one, the fact that his father was imprisoned. His father was taken a prisoner of war. Secondly, his house was actually the family chateau was actually commandeered by German officers. Lastly, he had always wanted a way. His mother was a person as well who was always very rebellious, and he wanted a way to fight this occupation. He thought it was a terrible thing, and he decided to try to get to London by any ways he could.
Right. Okay. So before we get to the London chapter,
sure.
But you mentioned his mother. She had the nickname the Terrible Countess,
which
probably sounds much better in French.
Yeah.
But how did she get that nickname, and who gave it to her?
It's the German officers who occupied the house. So the story goes, there was a German officer of some nobility, and he knew the La Rochefoucauld name.
Okay.
And so he comes to the family chateau. She is waiting there for him, all stocky frame and sort of furious gaze. And he walks up, he takes off his glove, and he says words to the effect of, you know, it is a great pleasure to be in a house as beautiful as this. And before he can kiss her hand, she takes it away and slaps him across the face.
Welcome.
And the officers were only half joking when they said, you know, doing something like that will risk deportation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they make a little joke like that, but she sounded pretty formidable.
Yeah, she was. Yeah,
there's all words. No bite in that. Okay, so you mentioned that La Rochefoucauld wanted to get to London. He wanted to get to London. Why?
Well, General de Gaulle, Charles de Gaulle, was broadcasting on the BBC. And these were pleas, really, for the country to continue the fight. Because the battle for France, for anybody who studied this, they, of course, know that it was over very quickly, in about 10 days' time. General de Gaulle gets to London. He says, no. We've got to find a way to continue the fight by any means possible. Join me, and you can be part of my Free French forces.
Okay, and so he gets to England. La Rochefoucauld gets to England. How did he get there?
He actually travels south. So he goes through Spain, because Spain was a neutral country. And there he sort of commandeered by a group of British officers who say, well, perhaps before you join the Free French, might we persuade you to join this new outfit that's working with the French but is under British employ.
Mm-hmm. And so this was an outfit, the Secret Operations Executive, sort of like what, a precursor of MI6 or a secret part of MI6?
It was actually formed apart from MI6, and it was known as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. anything that they could do, anarchy by any means, was really the motto. And so there was lock breaking. There was, you know, killing people with your bare hands, killing people by any means you could possibly imagine, sabotaging everything. You know, the difference between MI6 and SOE was that MI6 was sort of take in that information and try to discreetly execute on it, right?
Right.
SOE would literally, like, take that information and just bomb stuff.
And for those viewers of Scandal, it sounds like SOE is was the World War II equivalent of B-613. Just to give it a little pop.
If we want to make.
So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'm vaguely familiar. Okay, yeah.
Very good. So La Rochefoucauld gets to Charles de Gaulle.
Yeah.
And what happens?
So he told him how. Robert tells de Gaulle how the British had intervened and they wanted him to join this secret outfit. What did he think? And de Gaulle ultimately says, even if it's allied with the devil, it's still for France. Go. De Gaulle and the Brits had a very complicated relationship, just as de Gaulle and the Americans did. Roosevelt gave de Gaulle all of 2 days' notice before the North African landings, even though some of the territories there were French-controlled at the time. So Robert decides to train under with this British outfit, Special Operations Executive, and then he goes back to France as a proper resistant.
Okay, and so he gets trained in all the things you were talking about, killing people with the bare hands and marksmanship and everything. So we got to talk about the first mission that Rochefoucauld went on. Is this the one involving the limousine? Right.
This is the one that the escape involves a limousine.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So talk about this mission. So and the escape.
So he goes. He's parachuted into central France, and the first mission is fairly simple. It's basically just to go in and sabotage a few power plants, a few power lines, and he does this. He's actually training people. The remarkable thing is Robert's like 18, 19 years old at this time. He's training men working with other resistants who are sometimes in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, right? And a lot of them don't know who this guy is, except he seems to know a lot, and he seems to be able to get whatever ammunition, whatever weapons, whatever artillery he can, like, it just sort of appears.
Right, yeah.
So anyway, they do those missions, and but then he wants to go back and do another, but then he can't get another flight back to London. So there was this phrase that SOE would use. It's like basically 6 months in country and then you're a dead man. And so the 6 months start ticking. And then there were waves upon waves upon waves of arrests. There were the Nazis were very effective in France of infiltrating various resistance cells. And ultimately, Robert is imprisoned for 4 months, a terrible imprisonment in Auxerre, which is, again, in central France. And then he escapes, which is the limousine bit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, okay. Talk about the limousine. Yeah, because, I mean, before he gets to the limousine where he tries, like, doesn't he? He jumps out of a moving vehicle.
Yeah, so Robert is actually scheduled to be executed. On the day of his execution, he's told to sit on a coffin. And the Nazis take off on this truck, and they're going to go to this remote spot where I went with a local archivist and showed where all these resistants were shot during the war. Okay, so he's on the road, and he turns to the guy next to him, and he says, you know, the Nazis made a mistake. The one mistake that they made in his 4 months of imprisonment was that they never figured out how dangerous Robert actually was, and they had failed to handcuff him that day. So there's two armed guards on either side of him, and he thinks, you know, whether I die now or die later, I'm going to make a run for it. And the guy turns to him and goes, you're crazy. This is another inmate mm-hmm, who was scheduled mm-hmm. for his own execution that day. Robert says, I'm off. And so he barrels himself into one of the guards. And because he'd been trained, he knew how to jump from a vehicle, roll. And as soon as he finishes rolling, he takes off on a dead sprint. As he takes off on a dead sprint, the other German shooter in the back of the truck starts to take fire. As soon as he takes fire, the truck's driver, who's freaking out, he slams on his brakes, and so the second guy goes over the edge of the truck. So now there's no shooter shooting trying to get Robert, and so now Robert just takes off, and he's running down a street, and then he turns down one corner, and he sees these giant swastika flags, and it's the local Gestapo headquarters. And so now he's thinking, well, if I turn back and go the other way, is that more conspicuous than if I just try to keep walking? So he decides to keep walking down the street past this giant building. And then he hears the truck. And so now his truck's like a couple blocks off. So he looks around him real quick, and he sees a vehicle. And the vehicle, remarkably enough, has keys in the ignition. There's a driver who's waiting to take a Gestapo officer across town. The driver's about 30 paces off outside the vehicle. Robert sees the keys in ignition, hears the truck coming again, and says, I've got to make a break for it right now. He jumps into the car. He takes off. The driver realizes what's happening. He starts firing at him, but he misses. And so Robert actually takes off with these Nazi pennants at the end of the car, right. And they're whipping in the wind. And he goes actually right back by the prison where he'd been imprisoned for 4 months. And it was remarkable.
It crashes through the gate, the whole thing.
That anecdote actually goes on. But
as you were saying, this is the stuff that you would see in a 007 film.
Bingo.
And like, I can picture Daniel Craig doing all these things and thinking, that was really great, but that no way that would happen in real life. But this happened in real life.
Yeah, so I was actually just as incredulous when I started the reporting, because I'm like, man, this is amazing.
Right.
This is literally unbelievable. So one of the first things I did was try to make sure that all of did he actually receive these commendations from the French? And he did. And in particular with that anecdote, I teamed up with a local archivist, and we went through the local prison rolls at Auxerre. And sure enough, on the day in question, it shows that Robert de la Rochefoucauld escaped from prison.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, wow, like this. Time after time after time, I mean, those things checked out. I make a note in the book that sometimes I had to, the chronology wasn't quite right. Robert wrote his memoir 40 years after the war. So his own military records were sometimes, which were written much, much sooner, you know, mm-hmm. 1 to 5 years after the war. Sometimes I would use a chronology from that, but the episodes described, they all mm-hmm. had some independent verification.
There's so much in this book and in his story to get to, but we got to end the interview by talking about Maurice Papon.
Yeah.
Because this... He complicates the story of La Rochefoucauld. Talk about him real quickly.
So Maurice Papon... was a guy who worked in Bordeaux, and he worked for Vichy. He's working basically alongside the Nazis, and he put his signature on basically deportation papers where Jewish people in the Bordeaux area would go to ultimately their death.
Right.
It's very complicated because basically he was literally a guy who just signed off on orders. Mm-hmm. The orders came from above. 50 years later, in the mid-90s, he's tried for war crimes. And Robert, who had come to know him, also knew that there were Jewish resistance fighters who said that Maurice Papon helped free them. And there were various records in the French trial about this. And so Robert actually, after Papon's sentencing. He helped him flee to Switzerland. And that's where it really gets complicated, because people thought, and his own, Robert's own family was like, I can't believe you did this. But the reason he did it was ultimately because there were, he saw Papon as part of the Brotherhood of the Resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that it was worthwhile defending someone like that, even if someone like that came with so much baggage.
We actually have one more minute. One minute. So here's La Rochefoucauld doing all of these things. He's part of the resistance. He's James Bond of World War II, escaping death not once but twice.
Yeah.
And yet, in all of this, he had the time to meet his wife, Bernadette? When?
Well, Bernadette he actually met after
after his exploits.
But I there is a funny little story. So I'm visiting his daughter, Constance, and she is showing me all these photos of her father. And there are rows upon rows of girlfriends. And some of them have names and some of them don't. So it's just question marks next to him. So he was a very involved man during the war.
Yeah, because he was in his late teens. I've been speaking with Paul Kicks about one of the untold stories of the French resistance during World War II. His new book is The Saboteur, the Aristocrat Who Became France's Most Daring Anti-Nazi Commando. This Thursday, January 11th, Paul will be appearing at Community Bookstore at 7 p.m. That's at 143 7th Avenue in Brooklyn. Paul, thanks.
Thank you so much.